Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. The issue of modern science is all around us. As a matter of fact, you just pick up the newspaper, listen to the news report. It seems that many of the leading stories have to do with discoveries of the scientific form of technologies, bioethical issues, and all the rest. Today at my website at albertmohler.com, I posted a major article entitled "A Haunting Specter, Modern Science Without Moral Limits." And that's exactly where we're going to be looking today. Not so much at that thematic article, but at some very real-life cases that are proving the point that emerged out of just one weekend. Just this past weekend, a 12-year-old boy became the youngest sex change patient to undergo the operation and the treatment in Europe. You're talking about a 12-year-old. His name was Tim, soon to be Kim. That tells you a whole lot about where we're going with these new technologies. Also, the world's oldest woman to conceive by in vitro fertilization. You may remember a notorious case. She lied in order to obtain the treatments. She now is the mother, after the in vitro fertilization treatments, in advanced age of twin baby boys. Guess what? She can't handle it. She has made it clear in the European press that she's looking for a younger husband to help her take care of these babies. Again, you just start looking at it. Where's the normal here? Scientific advance led to the opportunity. And there you have it. Then the Washington Post, the same weekend, just this past weekend, on the international sale of human eggs and how this has become big business, the commodification of the human reproductive system and of gametes, eggs and sperm and all the rest. We're living in a brave new world, and a lot of people, a frighteningly large number of people, are saying, hey, if we can do it, we should do it. The very existence or development of a technology is its own justification. We as Christians are the people who are supposed to say, no, there have to be moral limits. Moral limits to our behavior in the financial world, moral behavior in terms of truth-telling, moral behavior in terms of every dimension of life, and science doesn't get a pass. It's absolutely frightening to think about a world in which whatever science does is declared to be good. One of the things we're going to be looking at today is that there are even members of Congress who say, look, once science makes something possible, then the moral questions just go out the window. I don't think so. Get ready to call. The number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We have been looking rather consistently at the work of Richard Dawkins, the Oxford scientist, geneticist, evolutionary theorist, who holds an esteemed chair in the history and philosophy of science at Oxford University. He's also perhaps the world's best-known atheist, and his book, The God Delusion, remains even now on the top 10 bestseller list, the New York Times list, that really dominates the publishing world. This is a part of something big happening among us, a revival of sorts when it comes to atheism. But Richard Dawkins' actual proposals are about as frightening in their unvarnished form as anything you're going to see anywhere. And yet, even in his books on atheism and all the rest, the true dark side of his philosophy of life rarely comes out. It comes out in the current issue of Free Inquiry magazine in an article he has written entitled Collateral Damage Part 1. His basic argument is that the use of human embryos in embryonic stem cell research should be considered just collateral damage. And he compares it to bombing. World War II, the war in Iraq, in any war, you send in the Air Force and they drop bombs, there's always going to be some collateral damage. Not only are you going to hit the targets you want to hit, but a bomb's going to fall somewhere. And he says if that's justified in war, then the loss of these human embryos, the destruction, intentional destruction of human embryos, should be seen as just another form of collateral damage. Get over it. Now, in this article, he says some things that he has not often championed in the public square. Now, last week we were looking similarly at Peter Singer. And at my website, several articles on Peter Singer in terms of making these same proposals. But listen to what Richard Dawkins says. He says this: let's look at the alleged negative side of killing embryos more carefully. The putative collateral damage. Collateral it certainly is, but is it damage? Damage to whom? Who suffers? Who feels bereaved? Who feels frightened? Don't misunderstand embryos, by the way. They're not fetuses with little hands and feet, that is, little miniature babies who open their mouths in the womb and even seem to cry. The embryos that are destroyed in stem cell research are blastocysts no bigger than a pinhead, consisting of no more than 150 cells. Such a tiny entity, almost too small for us to see, has no nervous system of any kind. He goes on and says, the moral objection to killing blastocysts, that's human embryos, then cannot be based on suffering. So what is it based on? Religion, almost always. It is partly a mystical reverence for humanness. Listen carefully to his words here. As though all cells of Homo sapiens are suffused with a divine essence, some sort of sacred juice possessed by no other species. In a previous column, he says, I called it Homo sap. Such a notion is fundamentally unevolutionary. Now here's the worldview at work. At what point in the line of descent from the common ancestor we share with chimpanzees was the divine essence first injected? If you set aside what it will eventually grow into, there is no important difference between a human blastocyst and that of any other mammal. Period. Okay, we got to stop there. You talk about opening the barn door. Listen to what he says here. He says, if you set aside what it will eventually grow into. How do you set aside what it will eventually grow into? We can't grant him that premise. The very fact that this is a human embryo cannot be separated from the fact that left unmolested in the human womb, it's going to grow into a human being, not a chimpanzee, not an ape. But also notice that it is Richard Dawkins here who says the idea of what we call the image of God, the imago Dei is the old theological term for it, what the scripture says, every single human being made in the image of God, he says that is fundamentally non-evolutionary. As a matter of fact, he says it even stronger than that. He says it's basically anti-evolutionary. It's fundamentally unevolutionary. Well, of course it is. Now, one of the helpful things in an article like this is that it helps to destroy the confusion of the middle. All these people who say, look, you can accept evolutionary theory and still hold on to a special human dignity. No, you can't. And Richard Dawkins, writing from the other side in a truly frightening article, helps to make that very clear. Let me just read to you again from his article. It's entitled Collateral Damage, Part 1, from Free Inquiry Magazine. He says this. So we are left with the fact that human blastocysts, which can feel nothing now, have the potential to develop eventually into beings that are capable of human suffering, human loves, hates and fears, and human consciousness. It seems to me an inadequate basis for an ethical decision. If you ask me whether I care more about the destruction of a blastocyst, remember human embryo, which theoretically has the potential to develop into a conscious human being, or the painful killing in an abattoir, that's a slaughterhouse, of an adult cow that has already reached its full potential, my answer is not in doubt. If I see a terrified cow about to have its throat cut by a Jewish or Muslim slaughter man who insists, and he goes on here, I want to intervene on its behalf. If I see a human blastocyst the size of a pinhead about to be flushed down the drain, do I want to intervene on its behalf? Oh, come on, get real. Well, there you have it. You know, when folks who are critics of those who hold the worldview of evolutionary biology and naturalistic materialism, those of us who are critics of this kind of atheism and its inevitable consequences, those of us who are critics of this kind of worldview are often accused of caricaturing the positions of the atheists and the evolutionists and all the rest. Well, this is just what he had to say. He goes beyond any caricature anyone could come up with to try to come up with a poster child or a cartoon of this worldview. Now remember, Richard Dawkins is not some peripheral person. He holds one of the most esteemed chairs in science in the world at Oxford University, and his ideas, well, if not mainstream, they're at least selling by the millions. Still, in the top 10 best-selling books in the United States of America, his book, The God Delusion. For more resources and for more information on Richard Dawkins, go to my website at Albert Mohler, that's MOHLER.com. And you'll find a great deal more. Speaking of science, by the way, one of the most controversial experiments going on right now in science is a study of gay sheep. I know that must fascinate you, but it made the front page of the New York Times because Charles Roselli, the scientist at the Oregon Health and Science University, who has been studying gay sheep for the past 5 years, has been looking for physiological factors that might explain the development of homosexual behavior in sheep. Guess who's upset about it? Well, two groups in particular, gay rights activists and people for the ethical treatment of animals. They have a common concern. What is it? That somebody's going to try to use this information to cure homosexuality. Now, yeah, follow me here. The headline of Gay Sheep, Modern Science, and the Perils of Bad Publicity. This is the New York Times last week. Charles Roselli's been looking at all of this. He is absolutely perplexed by the criticism that has come. And it's not just coming from people that, you know, are in the scientific community. One of the persons who has been arguing against this is Martina Navratilova, the famous tennis star, now retired, who says this: the more we play God or try to improve on Mother Nature, the more damage we're doing with all kinds of experiments that either have already turned or will turn into nightmares. How in the world could straight or gay sheep help humanity? In other words, if you're absolutely determined to make homosexuality normative, and by the way, they're the ones who've been trying to point out that the fact that it's supposedly found in the animal kingdom is supposed to be a clue to the fact that it's normative. Now, if they come up with a physiological cause, they could have a cure. They say that in itself, again, is a form of abuse. People for ethical treatment of animals say gay sheep ought to be left gay. Right. We're living in confused times and in a confused world. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Get ready to call 877-893-8255, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Very common for folks to say, you know, scientific knowledge and technology is basically value neutral. It all depends how you're going to use it. You can use it to do good things or bad things. You can use technologies to heal or to kill. You can use technologies to do things that will lead to a genuine human improvement, and others that will bring in rather draconian, really frightening things that could lead to great human evil. But the argument is that the knowledge and the technologies, they are themselves morally neutral. Yuval Levine, writing at the journal The New Atlantis, really pierces that argument very well. This is what he says. The moral challenge of modern science reaches well beyond the ambiguity of new technologies, because modern science is much more than a source of technology, and scientists are far more than mere investigators and toolmakers. Modern science is a grand human endeavor, indeed the grandest of its modern age. Its work employs the best and the brightest in every corner of the globe, and its modes of thinking and reasoning have come to dominate the way mankind understands itself and its place. I quoted President Richard M. Nixon, the late president, who, speaking of the economist John Maynard Keynes, said, "We're all Keynesians now." And what he meant is the entire economic world has changed. And in this sense, we're all scientists now. Because the scientific mode of thinking really has filtered down to much of everyday life. Our worldview is increasingly shaped by the influence of modern science, its findings, its technologies, and its basic worldview. But it's not morally neutral. Levine goes on to say many of us nonetheless think of science as neutral because it does not match the profile of a moral enterprise as understood in our times. Put simply, science does not express itself in moral declarations. It is neutral in the very way in which neutrality is seen to be a good thing in a free liberal society. Science does not tell us what to do. But as Mr. Levine understands, science does tell us what to do. Now, one of the interesting things in his article is how he shows that politicians and others simply say that now something has become possible, it has to happen. Eleanor Holmes Norton, the District of Columbia's delegate to the U.S. House of Representatives, as he said, gave this view at a recent hearing about the use of the abortion drug RU486. Observing that the FDA had said the drug was safe for women to use, Norton argued that this conclusion should end the debate. This is what she had to say. The unmitigated politicization of the one area that Americans always held off limits from politics, and that is science itself. Whether Shaivo or creationism, renamed intelligent design or stem cell research, or God help us, global warming itself, there are views floating around this Congress that essentially reach conclusions on these matters of huge scientific moment based on their own personal beliefs, end quote. Now, the naivety of that is just huge. She is so naive, she doesn't understand that scientists have their own agenda. And her argument is, hey, if the thing exists and scientists say it's safe, then you can't say not to use it. Safe is evidently, in her concern, the only criterion. That's all there is. But, of course, there's much more to that, much more to science and to technology than moral neutrality. And we see evidence of that. Three stories I want to share with you from just one weekend, just the last 3 days. Big developments. First of all, in Los Angeles, but reported now from London, a 67-year-old woman who is believed to be the world's oldest new mother told a British newspaper Sunday she lied to a U.S. fertility clinic saying she was 55 to get treatment. So she was actually 67. She said she was 55. That was the upper limit of this clinic in Los Angeles. Carmela Busada said in her first interview since she gave birth to twins on December 29, so we're just talking about a month ago, that she sold her house in Spain to raise $59,000 to pay for the in vitro fertilization in a California clinic. Quote, "I think everyone should become a mother at the right time for them," Busada said in a video of the interview provided to Associated Press Television News. Okay, this is what she's saying. She says, "I have the right to become a mother. I think everyone should become a mother at the right time for them." Now, again, technology is what alone makes that possible. There's no way that this 67-year-old woman was going to become pregnant through her own reproductive capacity with a husband. And, by the way, there is no husband. That becomes the substance of the story. So instead she lied. She had the in vitro fertilization treatment. She gave birth to twin boys, and she can't handle them. According to the newspaper, she now hopes to find a younger husband to help raise her two sons, Powell and Christian. Fascinating. Now she needs a husband. Why? Because these two little boys need a father. And because at age 67, she realizes that, and I guess now 68, that she is not going to be able to care for these boys for long. Now, don't tell me science is morally neutral and scientific technologies are morally neutral. The presence of this technology has allowed this. And once you separate reproduction from marriage, reproduction and sex and marriage altogether, then you end up with this, a 67 or 68-year-old new mom of twin boys who now needs a dad. Now, let's just remember the way it used to be. The dad came before the babies. And the way it used to be, there were very clear social sanctions that said the dad and the mom need to be married. Now, let's just think about the fact that had all that happened, we would not be talking about this today. But a scientific development has allowed that to happen. Scientific developments also have to do with, in modern medicine and beyond medicine and modern society, the debates over transsexuals, transgendered issues, and sex change operations. Coming from Vienna, the Sunday Telegraph of London is reporting that the youngest ever transsexual is now identified as a 12-year-old boy. The Sunday Telegraph is one of the major newspapers in Great Britain, owned, by the way, by the same people that own Fox News and other outfits here. A boy of 12 is believed to have become the world's youngest sex change patient after convincing doctors that he wanted to live the rest of his life as a female. The boy, originally called Tim but now known as Kim, has started to receive hormone treatment in preparation for the operation that will eventually complete the sex change. He was diagnosed as a transsexual 2 years ago. Reading from the news report here. A 10-year-old boy who's diagnosed as a transsexual. And doctors and psychiatrists concluded that his claims to be in the wrong body were so deeply felt that he required treatment. The therapy involves, I'm not going to read you the specifics, but artificially arresting male puberty with a series of potent hormone injections before the administration of female hormones to initiate the development of, well, female puberty. Obviously, surgery is going to be required, too. And it says that now, and I'm going to quote from the articles on the way I can get through this. Kim looks like a typical girl of her age. She dresses in fashionable clothes, has long blonde hair and blue eyes, and dreams of moving to Paris to become a fashion designer. Her parents, who initially assumed their son was going through a temporary phase, eventually grew accustomed to seeing him as a girl. All right, let's just rewind for a moment here. 12-year-old boy. Well, let's just go back to when he was 10. Says he's in the wrong body. His parents take him to specialists. What do they have up on the wall? Degrees, certificates. All these authoritative recognitions and certifications on the part of the scientific community. They're scientists. They're supposed to know what they're talking about. They're supposed to be morally neutral. And the next thing you know, at age 12, he's undergoing a sex change operation. Now, there's so many things going on here. Just think about, children, adolescents, parental rights. Just think about the culture of personal autonomy that now says a 10 or 12-year-old boy has the right to make this kind of determination now. I mean, just think about adolescence and think how many different phases of life kids go through in that period of life. You know, just taking the moral considerations aside for just a moment, as if we could do that, just developmentally, this doesn't make any sense. But that's where we are today. This story, by the way, is getting a lot of traction in the world press, and you could imagine that everything's pretty much lining up for and against here. Then the Washington Post, finally. Big story on the global trade in human eggs. It is absolutely huge. You've got women who are traveling internationally, serving as egg donors, and you have intermediaries that are going into customized babies and all the rest. They want this particular kind of egg. They're willing to pay a great deal for it. In some clinics, they say they're paying for the woman's time rather than for her gametes, that is, for her eggs. But, you know, ethically speaking, no one's buying that. We're living in a world in which donor eggs, donor gametes, donor sperm, all these things are now becoming big business. People are advertising online, both offering for sale and offering to buy the stuff of which human beings are made. The phone number is 877-893-8255. The issue is modern science, its promise, and its peril. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Well, welcome back. You know, one of the reasons we're talking about this today is because very few others are. It's not to say that the news isn't out there in the media. It's pretty widespread. I mean, after all, you start talking about a 12-year-old getting sex change therapy and eventually an operation. You start talking about the widespread sale of human eggs. And then you talk about a woman who's 67 years old that lied in order to get IVF treatment and now has twin boys and needs a younger man as a husband to help take care of them. You're touching stuff that even the media knows is worth talking about. But the kind of conversation we're having goes beyond the sensationalism of the fact that these things are happening. And I hope we're beginning to peel back layer after layer in order to ask the question, how could this have happened? In other words, what kind of barriers had to be lowered? What kind of lines had to be blurred? What kind of knowledge had to be forgotten for us to get to this point? The phone number is 877-893-8255. I want to know, are you ready to live in this world? Or are you ready to say, we've got to get some control over these technologies and over these scientific, the word they use is advances, these scientific developments, in order to say, left unchecked, what we're seeing is the complete redefinition of the human race, a self-redefining of the human race. You're talking about 67-year-old women having babies. You're talking about 12-year-old boys having sex change therapies. And you're talking about people selling their reproductive capacity, sperm and eggs and all the rest, on the market in order that people can order, in many cases, what amounts to customized babies. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I decided we had to talk about this. When I had scheduled this issue of the moral neutrality of science for an upcoming program, and then just this past weekend, it was like all of a sudden there's a flood of these various news articles. We've got calls coming in from across America, the number 877-893-8255. I want to tell you a little bit more about what to me is in many cases the most tragic of these stories, and this is Tim, the boy who's now Kim, supposedly a girl. Der Spiegel, which is like the Time magazine of Germany, says that at age 2, Tim tried on his older sister's clothes, played with Barbies, and said, I'm a girl. His parents thought it was a phase, but at the age of 4, Tim was still bawling after every haircut. At last, he ran into his room with a pair of scissors and hollered that he wanted, do his own surgery. And it was clear to his parents that the problem was serious. From then on, Tim went by Kim. Now listen to this. I want you to listen. This is Der Spiegel. Again, this is like you're reading Time magazine, translated from the German. Now just listen to this paragraph. It makes the point. The family, that is Tim's family, wanted a less complicated future for Tim, but they've also found reasons for optimism. Listen to this. They've learned that transsexuality has nothing to do with homosexuality. It's not about feather boas and red light districts so much as identity. Transsexuals aren't queer birds. They want the perfectly normal life of the opposite sex, and some will submit to radical methods from hormones to surgery to conform their bodies to the right gender, end quote. The key words there are, they learned. Well, where did they learn that? I mean, who says that? Well, they evidently think they learned it from science, but how does science actually come up with something like that? You see, this is one of the weird things about the age in which we're living. Every time we talk about issues of gender, I start getting emails from people who say, you just don't know what you're talking about. I got one just today by email, someone saying, when you talk about gender, you don't know what you're talking about. Well, who does know what they're talking about? Scientists. And the gender specialists, which, by the way, are some of the most ideologically driven postmodern academics. This stuff is basically just made up. But if it's made up by people who are assumed to have a background in science, then all of a sudden we're supposed to wipe the slate clear of human experience. We're supposed to forget about everything we know about male and female. We're supposed to forget anything about a duality of human genders and complementarity and all the rest. We're supposed to forget everything we know about marriage and sex and reproduction and just say, all right, let's just all learn together what science is now going to tell us. We can have sex without babies, babies without sex, choose our gender, buy eggs on the market. And pretty soon we don't even have to have our own children, because not only, I say pretty soon, it's really now, although the reality is not all that widespread in middle America, you can just go out and buy the gametes and hire a surrogate mother to carry the child. That's not science fiction, folks. This is going on around the world. There are people willing to pay a lot of money to be able to see it done. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. When we come back, we're going to take your calls. The issue is this. Are you ready for this world? Or do you think it's high time somebody said there have to be moral limitations on science and technology? What would you say to a 12-year-old boy who said, the scientists say, I can do this? We'll be right back. Modern world comes to us with a lot of imperatives. Do this, do that. One of the main imperatives the modern world seems to throw at us is this. If it's possible, it ought to be done. If you can build a building that high, you got to build it. If you can build a bridge that long, you got to do it. If you can create this, there's a moral imperative to go do it. We really have to rethink that, because we're living in an age in which all kinds of things are possible that should never be done. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Carol, listening on WHCB in Johnson City, Tennessee. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I just wanted to say that exactly what you were just saying now, that just because we have the technology, even where moral lines are not blurred, doesn't mean that we should use it.
Yeah, I appreciate that point, Carol, and I appreciate you calling as a woman. I want to direct you, if you'll go with me, to the story about the 67-year-old woman who lied in order to get the IVF treatments and now has the two little boys. Let me just ask, you know, just how odd does that sound to you?
Well, it's strangely odd, although I can understand her desire to have a child. I personally cannot understand the means by which she went around about doing it. And
well, you went right where I wanted you to go, because I need, you know, as a man, there are limitations on my understanding of her situation, but I want to be empathetic. But I guess what I'm looking for here is that, you know, if you're 67 and you're unmarried at 67 and you have, as this woman acknowledges, forfeited her opportunities to be married and to have children earlier, is it reasonable, ethical, or right to think that at age 67, even if the technology is available, I have the moral right to use it, when the reality is she's not going to be able to raise these children, and even now she really can't handle them? That's why she's looking for a younger husband. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I mean, at 43, I would love to have another child, but those thoughts come into my mind at 43. I am married and I have a husband, and we could easily have another child, but will I be able to raise that child, you know, past age 20? So I don't know. I think that, you know, as I told your screener, my father has Parkinson's disease and had deep brain stimulation surgery, which left him not the man he was before the surgery, although it helped his Parkinson's. He lost his mind. And so should we have utilized that technique just because it was available?
That's a great question to ask. And Carol, I know you and your family had to really struggle with that. And I think, you know, there are all kinds of medical quandaries where we will end up standing back saying, you know, we hope we did the right thing. You know, in response to that, and Carol, thank you so much for your call. I want to say, I think the bottom line in all of this, and one of the reasons why we really needed to discuss this today, is so that Christians, thinking about this as Christians, operating from a Christian worldview that begins with human beings made in the image of God, and understanding that every dimension of life is moral, I think we had better think carefully as Christians, and most importantly as churches, about how we ought to think about these issues, developments, technologies, discoveries, and how we ought to place limitations upon ourselves in terms of the use of these things, even if the larger world refuses to recognize such limitations. We talked last week about the fact that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists is calling for routine screening for Down syndrome. And as George Will said, it's a search and destroy mission against babies that are in the womb and are marked by a likelihood for Down syndrome, because at least 80% of those fetuses, those babies that are diagnosed as having the likelihood of Down syndrome were aborted. Now, we better be the people who decide right up front, you know, the world may allow that. There may be no law, chilling as it is to say, against that. But if we really believe that every single human being is made in the image of God, we can't do that. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this today is because we better decide that before we find ourselves in this situation. We better think carefully as Christians and as churches about how we will advise each other under the authority of God's word and with the most faithful Christian thought and reasoning we can bring, how we would advise each other, limit each other, and limit ourselves in the use of some of these technologies. I'll tell you something that's coming that's going to be really difficult for us all. If and when, and this is a potential, but it's a potential that holds a lot of potential to be actual. What if they come along in a few years and say, look, in Great Britain and Germany and in the Netherlands, maybe even in the U.S., in a research laboratory near you, there is developed some therapy out of human embryonic stem cell research. And the reality is that it requires, in the use of this treatment, in order to have what are called the totipotent cells, the stem cells, you'll be required to clone yourself and to use the embryos in the that are made out of that clonal technology and destroy them in order to come up with the stem cells that will cure, supposedly, if it should happen. And we do want the cures in the right way from the right kind of stem cells. Alzheimer's, diabetes, you know, you name it, any number of these things. Christians are going to find themselves in a very difficult position. Now, our great hope scientifically, our great hope in terms of modern science is that indeed the right kind of stem cells will lead to those cures rather than the wrong kind, the right kind being those that are non-embryonic, that do not come from a human embryo and do not require the destruction of a human embryo. The most promising of these right now are coming from the umbilical cord. And, you know, what we're discovering is, by the way, that the only actual therapies developed out of human stem cell research have come not out of embryonic stem cell research, but out of donated stem cells that have come from adult cells of living human beings that require no destruction of a human embryo. You know, there are big challenges out there for us because once a medical technology becomes available, you know, it just becomes almost very quickly something that's categorized as a best practice. You just do this. If you have this disease, this is the therapy. If you have this problem, this is the treatment. And just imagine when Christians are going to have to say, you know, I can't do that. I can't go there. We can't use that. The world's going to scratch its head. It may be a great opportunity to talk about the gospel. It's certainly going to be a necessary opportunity to talk about the collision between the Christian and non-Christian views of what it means to be human. I want to come back to my main point here. Out there listening to this program today, not only are moms and dads and business persons and commuters going back and forth to work, but there are likely to be some people that have to deal with these things very quickly, maybe in a medical school class, maybe in a high school classroom, maybe in a conversation with your neighbors. We better talk about these things. And again, I come back to the fact that the church, as the true Christian counterculture, had better decide very quickly where we see these limits to lie. And as a matter of Christian accountability, we better teach them. And as a matter of Christian responsibility, we better hold them. I'll be right back. Some of you are already thinking you need to read a little more about this, think a little more about this. Overnight, I'm going to be publishing a major article to link together these three stories with the big picture. And, of course, my article up right now about modern science without moral limits will give you kind of a background to what we're talking about here. Some people out there are saying, you know, I don't face these realities. I don't see these things. I don't have to worry about them. Well, your kids will, your grandchildren will, and many are right now. I want to switch gears here just a moment and go back to the story about this 12-year-old boy who is right now undergoing these treatments as the youngest transsexual, according to the press. And by the way, the press says that it began when he was 12, but that he, Tim, who's now called Kim, is now 14. and that the sex change operation in terms of the physical part will have to wait until the individual is 18. That kind of gives you an update on where it is. But as I said, every time we talk about this, I hear from people who say, you don't know what you're talking about. So let me tell you the credentials I have to talk about gender issues. I'm not a postmodern philosopher in the academy. I'm not a professor of gender studies, and I'm not a doctor working in these areas. I am a theologian and a minister of the gospel and a scholar in terms of the history of the church, and especially is dealing with these theological and ethical issues. I can tell you what Christians have believed and why we have believed these things on the basis of the Word of God. And I want to come back and say that everything I know about gender, I know from the Bible. I don't know it from a scientific study. I don't know it from social science research. I don't know it from extended philosophical thought in a postmodern seminar trying to come up with gender as a social construct. Everything I know about gender, I know from the Word of God. And what the Bible says so clearly is that God made every single human being in His image. But in His image, He made human beings as male and female. Male and female created He them. It's not just a story to give meaning to life. It is an anchor to understand that our existence, our shape, our form, our sexuality is not an accident. It's a part of God's perfect plan for us. Out there listening to this program right now, maybe some people who, like that 12-year-old boy, are struggling with your own gender, your own consciousness of all of this. And there are people out there saying to you, look, what you need is a sex change operation. What you need is gender therapy. You know, what you need is to just exercise your personal autonomy to figure out who you want to be, and you claim it. I want to suggest to you, and I want to do this as respectfully as I possibly can, that what's most important for you is what your Creator intended for you. And if you're struggling with these issues, I would encourage you to turn to a very responsible Christian source, perhaps a pastor or a Christian friend to whom you can talk. I hope you'll turn to the Word of God and just ask the Lord to open your eyes as you read these passages, and you see that it's not just talking about humanity, it's talking about you. Just remember that God's plan for you is always perfect. And God's plan for us is always better than the plans we would make for ourselves. I pray we all find that and hold to it as an act of Christian faithfulness. I'll meet you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.